Today on Maine Calling, the impact of the vice presidential debate. Last night's nationally televised debate between the two vice presidential candidates drew millions of viewers. But will it make a difference in the election? The debate between Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance was much more cordial than recent presidential debates and actually focused on policy. Today, both political parties are claiming victory. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the most effective moments for each candidate, their policy positions, and whether the event will sway any voters to change their minds come November. Did last night's debate affect your vote? The style and substance of the vice presidential debate. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The vice presidential debate last night between Senator J.D. Vance and Governor Tim Walz was markedly different from recent presidential debates. For one, it was more civil. Today, we dive into the political impact of the debate with our experts. Gene Cummings, former deputy bureau chief in Washington for the Wall Street Journal. Ron Schmidt, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. And Nicholas Jacobs, assistant professor of government at Colby College and author with Dan Shea of the book The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place, and the Disuniting of America. We invite you to join the conversation. What did you think of the debate? Did anything that the candidates say stick with you? Did the debate change your mind about who you're going to vote for? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Today's program, we should note, part of our Your Vote 2024 election coverage. Gene, a lot has been made about how civil the debate was, how the candidates talked about actual policy, about issues. What are your thoughts today about what happened last night?
Well, I agree with those thoughts and that analysis that I thought both the candidates and the moderators led a discussion that could have been clarifying for voters on who are concerned about certain issues. Overall, though, I think both of the candidates performed pretty well. I thought Governor Walz was a little slow to start, but kind of caught his stride. I thought J.D. Vance was better prepared for the opening with the introduction of himself to the viewers. I thought that was good recognition on their part that he's been making lots and lots of campaign appearances, but this was one of his first moments on the national stage and in such a spotlight, and he put it to good use to try to combat some of the impressions that he's made, which are generally negative. And I think he probably helped himself overall with both his introduction and the non-weirdness about his appearance. He was very civil and very targeted on focusing on Harris and not really on Walz.
Ron, I saw a USA Today article this morning that says that Walz won by 50. The people they polled, voters who watched, thought that Walz got 49% and Vance 51%. In other words, I'm not saying this well, that pretty darn close in terms of what the general public thought about who did well in the debate. It makes me think, does this make have any impact at all in the election?
Generally speaking, vice presidents don't make much of an impact, debates or non-debates. The primary job for a vice presidential candidate during a campaign is to not do any damage. And neither of them certainly did any damage to their tickets last night. In fact, you might say that Vance's ticket did more damage to him. I think he was sort of trying to present himself not as the angry firebrand of the campaign road, but of a more calm and capable possible bipartisan policymaker. And at the end of the day, he's still arguing for some of Donald Trump's policies, which just don't really fit that affect. But I'd say I doubt very much that anyone really had their minds changed last night. I think probably the only possible blow that landed with any kind of echo or resonance came at the very end, when Walls sort of zeroed in on the issue of January 6th. And he's bringing up Mike Pence, because at the end of the day, we don't really, I think, need much of a reminder of the significance of the fact that it's not Mike Pence on the stage, and that we know the reason for that.
You're talking about when he turned to J.D. Vance and asked if he believed that Donald Trump had actually won the election.
Yes.
Yeah. Nick Jacobs, I'm especially interested in your lens because you've just written a book on the rural voter. And here both J.D. Vance and Tim Walz are presenting themselves as representatives of rural America. Wondering, with that lens, what did you see last night?
Right. So I was expecting Vance to deliver his familiar elegy of rural dystopia, right? A drug-addled, angry people. And then on stage left, I was expecting Walz to give us his folksy tribute to small town values. And the truth of the matter is, I think most rural people find themselves stuck in the middle. And I think most rural people still find themselves stuck in the middle between those two images. I didn't hear as much about rural politics as I thought I would, given that they are stylizing themselves in that way. We did finally hear the words rural. We heard it three times, and we even heard about Walls and farmers in Minnesota. And that's a pretty low bar to clear. You have to go back to 2019 for rural issues to make it into a presidential debate. But I thought, especially given the focus on specific policy issues, neither candidate contextualized them in a rural-specific manner. They didn't talk about the environment, with the exception of Walls and the environment, very briefly. So I thought it was a disappointment in that regard.
Gene, who was the debate targeted to? As Walls and Vance were preparing, who were they hoping to reach last night? And the second part of that question is, are the people they were trying to reach even watching last night? Oh boy, it looks like we've lost Gene, so I'll ask you that question, Ron. Who were Walls and Vance trying to reach last night, and did they even reach them? Did those people even watch?
I mean, their primary audience, I think, was probably an attempt to reach undecided voters, judging from their performances. They're assuming that their bases are supporting them. There was less of an attempt to sort of fire up their bases and get them motivated than I expected, but I think there was an attempt. And as I've said on this stage before, there are not very many undecided voters left in the country, but with a race as close as even the debate apparently was last night, they can be decisive.
Gene, when we're talking about undecided voters, and we've already talked about some sort of keywords that emerged in the debate, rural, bringing up Mike Pence. I was really interested in the focus at the very end on the word energy. And I'm wondering what else you heard in terms of trying to signal that undecided voter in a way that might go over the heads of somebody who's already decided how they're going to vote and is not part of that group of people still undecided.
Yeah, it's difficult to see how a vice presidential candidate is going to tip the scales to a ticket. As Ron said, the goal is do no harm, and they both accomplished that goal. There were the moment that I thought was interesting beyond the ending was a discussion around abortion. In which I think that Vance really tried to muddle the issue and not to the Trump ticket's credit, in the way that, we know Trump was for so long so outspoken and applauded the overturning of Roe v. Wade, took credit for it. Then he started muddling his own position when we started seeing the political fallout from that court decision. And, I felt like Vance muddied the waters even further, trying to appear compassionate on the issue when at the same time the Republican Party has for a very long time been having a very solid anti-abortion position. So, I'm not sure if anything really moved undecideds, but I don't think he handled that particular moment well.
Nick, I'm going to return to my question about energy in a little bit differently. I thought it was a little, at first, I thought this is a little unusual for J.D. Vance to use his summary, his final words, to talk about energy. And then it occurred to me that I think it's a bigger deal in rural America than America at large. I know that people in Maine, for example, are in the midst of a debate about how many solar farms should be allowed on farmland. We're talking about the transportation pipelines that go through rural America, wind farms. The cost of transportation is more if you have to drive more. Did you hear that as well? As I thought about it, I thought, is that why J.D. Vance ended his entire almost 2 hours by talking about energy?
It's also a very visible contributor to inflation, which continually ranks as the single biggest issue on the minds of voters. And I think that's why you heard a lot about energy and energy development and energy policy, as well as about housing, which is also a large contributor to inflation. I'll add, I agree with my colleagues that vice presidential debates, right, seldom do they matter. Vice presidents themselves, right, they matter kind of only on the margins and really in like their home state. But there's two things that make me pause in the historical comparison. This election is rather unique in that you have two incumbents, and when a majority of voters tell pollsters that they're looking for change, where are you going to look for change? It's not in the two incumbents at the top of the ticket. It may be down ballot. Just again, a small segment, I agree, of the electorate being undecided. And the other thing is, although Joe Biden dropped out of the race and we kind of stopped talking about age as an issue afterwards, Donald Trump's almost 80. And if there's any reservations left about age, right, it's the Republicans' burden to bear. There's energy policy and then there's energy on the stage. And I think Vance came out saying, God forbid, something happens. I'm a competent person that can fill in his shoes.
Ron.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that there's been talk about the enormous unpopularity of Vance as a candidate since the very beginning. And I think that he probably saved himself on the ticket last night. But he's also got to be thinking more long term about trying to carve out a persona for him that will outlast whatever it is that happens this November.
So Jeannie's trying to sort of neutralize the childless cat lady comment.
Absolutely. That was a real blow to him, and cast him in such a negative light. Talking when he kind of conceded that Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio are not eating their neighbors' cats and dogs, but he was willing to put or stand by a false story, if it created, if it forced the media to focus on the issue of immigrants. Both of those things hurt him really badly. And that's why I said, and at the outset, that I felt like their decision to have him take a minute of his first 2 minutes to really introduce himself to the national public was a smart move on their part, because I'm sure that was intended to try to mitigate some of the impressions that people have of him that are not very positive. And you know, he came across when, you know, he showed some compassion to Governor Walz about his son witnessing a shooting. You know, there are other ways where he humanized himself, I think, in a good way.
I want to talk about two things that I think both candidates, well, each candidate did one thing that I thought maybe might have struck a discordant tone. And I'll go back to you, Ron. When J.D. Vance said basically to the moderators, "Hey, I thought you weren't going to fact check me," or something like that. I'm not sure that was the best thing to say is, "Wait a minute, I only came on stage as long as nobody was going to fact check me." And when Tim Walz called himself a knucklehead, what did you make of those two moments?
I think that in a way it was problematic for Walz to have that question first off because he stumbled over it. But on the other hand, he was able to build up momentum over the rest of the debate. So that might have it might have sort of contained what was a rocky answer to a question that he could have handled more easily. What I thought was interesting with Vance in that regard was that he followed that up almost immediately by continuing to talk and going through the process of trying to make an argument that this app idea is important to how we determine who gets to be a refugee, until finally the moderator said, "Thank you for explaining the legal process." I think that probably hurt him with independent women. He was, as people say, mansplaining to cover up a gaffe. A glimpse of this persona that he's had on the trail that does not poll well with women, particularly with suburban women. So I think both of them did not handle being fact-checked well. Walz's was more, I think, plausibly inexperienced, less hostile, though, than Vance, who at that point I think came across as really passive aggressive.
We do need to take a quick break. We are talking about last night's vice presidential debate. Love to hear your impressions. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We have political experts with us today to analyze last night's vice presidential debate. With me, Ron Schmidt, professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Southern Maine, Gene Cummings, former deputy bureau chief in Washington for the Wall Street Journal, and Nick Jacobs, who is assistant professor of government at Colby College. Join the conversation, share your reaction to the debate. However, it appears we may be having a little bit of a problem with our phone line, so I'm going to encourage you to send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or if in a few minutes we get these lines back, you can call at 1-800-399-3566. So go to email talk@mainepublic.org, and I will go to an email right now. This is from Lisa. Lisa writes, "Please address the untruths on Vance's part." Nicholas, I think one that stood out was the Vance over and over insisting that Donald Trump saved Obamacare, saved the ACA. Do you think the audience, how do you think the audience perceived of these, as Lisa says, untruths?
I think there are untruths. I think there are flat-out lies. I think your average person tuning in can see through them at times. And then I think a lot of it gets missed because the untruths are in the gray areas and on the margins. And I think voters are sort of they're used to being lied to quite a bit now. And I don't know what your typical voter hears when they hear, Donald Trump saving Obamacare, other than, during Obamacare, what they know about Obamacare is that maybe they have a deep belief that it did not work for them. Maybe they have a deep belief that when they hear Obamacare, they hear the lie first and foremost in their mind that they were allowed to keep their doctor, but then they had to get rid of their doctor. And so under Donald Trump, even though he tried to repeatedly gut this, although it was the Biden-Harris administration that really increased subsidies to put a larger share of the American population on expanded Medicaid coverage, that untruth to you and me, avid followers of politics, following the fact checkers, may not be an untruth to your voter.
All right. And Jean, I know that over the years you've done focus groups with voters. What have you learned about these things that candidates say during debates that you know as a journalist not to be true? But does the audience know that?
No, they don't, and they forget. I mean, the attention span of people here in America and across the world, we all know is pretty short. And, it's been years since McCain cast the vote to save Obamacare against the wishes of then President Trump. But many voters just don't remember how intense that battle was. And I was recently moderating a panel on the presidential campaign with a Democrat and Republican operatives. And, I asked the Republican, Donald Trump ran very clearly in 2016 on a platform of getting rid of the Affordable Care Act. And we don't hear him talk about it anymore. Instead, he talks about he having some concepts about how he might change healthcare and how it works. And I asked him, is this debate over? And he essentially conceded that it was. I mean, there are millions and millions of people now who are getting their healthcare through the Affordable Care Act. Generally, they are pleased with the way it works. And so the Republicans, have moved on. And, but, so Vance saying that Trump salvaged it, people barely remember there was a fight over it because our attention spans just aren't that great. All of us, I lived through it, the fight on the Hill, edited the stories about McCain's vote and Trump's reaction. I'm very familiar with it, and you all are too, but that's because what we do makes us focus on it. But most people are busy, living their lives, and they've moved on, and they can't fact check candidates in the middle of a debate based on what they do may or may not recall.
Here's an email from Allison that is to this point, and Ron, I'll send this one to you. Allison writes, "I think Walz must have chosen in advance not to address most of Vance's lies, just because then the debate would have been mostly about lies." What do you think of that analysis from Allison?
I think Allison's called it. Senator Vance lied a lot. And he did it in a very, not the sort of angry, blustery way that Donald Trump does, but in a very sort of just chatting with you kind of way that could have had Walz playing defense for the entire evening. Gene's right. People don't watch debates like political junkies do, or like media fact checkers. I mean, I'm a political scientist, and I like debates, and I was preparing for today's show. And I was still folding laundry through a part of the debate last night while I was listening. People are multitasking, and they don't. I think for me, the more worrisome problem is an assumption on the part of a lot of the public that although they might not catch lies, that they assume that lying is something that politicians just do. And so if you spend too much time trying to point out the fact that one side is lying, that can only just sort of feed into this sense among their followers that, well, what do you expect? So I think you've got to pick your battles well. And Allison is right that I think Walz was trying to do that.
An email here from Mark. I was disappointed with the debate for at least two reasons. I wanted to learn more about the candidates who would take office if the president were dead, demented, assassinated, or impeached. Beyond Walz's experience governing, I did not learn what experience Vance had, whether he would continue Project 2025, how he voted on inflation reduction, border security, job creation, etc. I also wanted to hear what a social studies teacher could remind a MAGA businessman about, quote, common sense, how to settle disagreements about what is with science, our constitution, or the three branches of government, how it applies to global warming, pandemics, women's health care, immigration, etc., and how it relates to Thomas Paine's 1776 foundational document about kings, equality, and representation. So, Nicholas, we're hearing from somebody who's disappointed, who was looking for something very specific and did not hear it.
Yeah, some really specific things that I would have loved to have heard too. And I think that's why, you know, in one way, all the focus on policy and specific statistics, like, it was refreshingly elevated in comparison to the last two debates, in comparison to maybe the last dozen years of debate. But it did overlook the fact that these two men and the campaigns that they were representing last night do have fundamental differences, the big visions that they have for the country. Both have spoken about it, and you know, you didn't really get much from Vance last night on much of the commentary he's delivered the last couple of months on what it means to be an American, how American values are tied to a particular group of people rather than a set of ideas. We haven't heard too much from Walz elaborating on what his vision of America is in that regard. And so in getting so hung up on the policy particulars, I did think they missed a chance to speak to those not just larger stories about themselves and the experiences they have, but what the two campaigns are clearly trying to represent and where they see America going and where we're heading currently at this moment.
Gene, I want to ask a question about how voters and the general public might perceive of, I guess the question would be style and substance. I think that most people would agree that J.D. Vance was more articulate last night, who had answers that were more energetic, though Tim Walz seemed more relatable. And I'm wondering, I know people who think that Walz got creamed by Vance, and I know other people who think that Vance came across as a little, you know, cheesy sales guy. And I'm wondering how you see the public responding to the different personalities last night.
Well, I do think Walz was pretty relatable. I mean, I thought his knucklehead comment was really relatable for people. You know, he's been in public office a long time. Everyone in public office has made a mistake at some point in their remarks. You know, it wasn't like he never went to China. It's just he blew the dates. And so I thought that that was good. I also thought, and I'd like to hear what Nick thinks, I thought it was smart of Walz to talk about his interaction with his farmers, because that's a real human event that people can relate to. And as for Vance, I thought he came across very well. I thought he was well coached. He's clearly smart, good on his feet, but he's only been in elective office for 2 years. We forget how inexperienced he is. And so he was well prepped and well trained, in part because he hasn't done this for very long and he needed to be prepped and trained. So I just felt like Walz, once he got his legs under himself after the first 15 minutes or 20 minutes or so, I thought that was smart of him to start talking about his life experiences as a governor.
All right. And it does appear our phones are working again. 1-800-399-3566. Nick, Jean said she wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
I think that's why governors usually have an advantage in these types of things over senators, especially senators with very limited experience. It's a very personable office. I thought Walz did excel when he was able to bring up his deep history and in his state, both as a representative of a pretty rural district, as a rural person himself, but then as a governor in Minnesota. And I think Walz, you know, I think he excels when he does that. I think that's part of the reason why the Harris team selected him on the ticket. I think that's why this policy focus last night may have thrown him off his game a little bit, at least at first. That said, you know, one thing governors do struggle in speaking to is foreign policy issues. And I think that was an area where Walz is really an unknown to voters. As a governor of Minnesota, you don't have much opportunity to weigh in on crises in the Middle East or the war in Ukraine. I don't think Vance pressed his advantage as a sitting U.S. senator on some of those issues, but I don't think Walz made fully accomplished the goal of telling voters that, hey, a second in command as the president's final word potentially is somebody that has to sub in. I am a safe bet on the global stage.
Mm. And I was also struck by Nick that he was a governor in that he was a booster for his own state. We heard multiple times about the great healthcare coverage there, the Fortune 500 companies, that kind of thing, which I suspect he couldn't even help, even if he had tried to help. I'm going to go to this email from Jack. And Ron, I think this is interesting. Jack writes, over the past two debates, the Democratic candidates continue to say that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, without giving any explanation as to how. In fact, if you go back and listen to Kamala Harris' speeches, she mentions how democracy is in danger, but never goes into any detail. Isn't it undemocratic for one party to say the other is a threat to democracy? Isn't that extremely hypocritical?
I mean, it's problematic unless the side that's talking genuinely thinks the other side is a threat to democracy. I think there is a sense among not only Democratic politicians, that Donald Trump does pose a fundamental threat to the ordinary workings of American government. And so I don't think that hypocrisy is what we're seeing there so much as it is that Harris's campaign is trying not to focus in so much on Donald Trump. I think that scene is something that Joe Biden did, that maybe he in particular could sort of pull off, but that has limitations to it, and that Harris is trying to carve a message that is a reason to vote for her rather than a reason to vote against Trump. And that's this leitmotif of freedom. But she still doesn't want to leave Trump unaddressed. And so instead of getting that kind of focus, we get these references. And it's true, you know, the references can be fleeting and lack the backup evidence. But I think that's what happens when you're trying to thread this needle.
An email here from Betsy. How could they not have mentioned that J.D. Vance wrote the foreword to the Project 2025 and asked him if he supported all the policies that are outlined there? Jean, I'm going to turn to you. How resonant a campaign issue is Project 2025? And why do you think it was not a big part of the debate last night?
Well, I've actually been a moderator of a debate. I did Hillary and Obama in their primary. And when you're putting together questions for a debate like this, there are a lot of things you've got to consider. And one of them is, will it elicit a real answer? And the Trump campaign and Vance have both taken the position that they are not associated with 2025, or at least they're not going to follow it. And that's harder for Vance to say, given that he wrote the introduction, as the caller points out. And so it could have been a decent question to ask. But the predictable answer would be the Trump campaign has not embraced the 2025 report as its agenda, and no one can say they have. So, it's a legitimate question they could have asked, but I think they probably didn't because it wasn't going to elicit an insightful response, and instead would have probably drawn a predictable response. So.
Yeah, and what about Walz not bringing it up?
Yes, he certainly could have. And I think Walz did try to turn the tables a couple of times that were more effective than that. I mean, part of the problem with the whole 2025 report is that most Americans don't really know what it is. So when you're on a national stage and you throw that out, probably most viewers aren't really going to know what you're talking about. And if they have to Google it, they're not going to bother. So, better to stick with something that where, people have a better chance of knowing what you're talking about. It's like we were talking about earlier, those sort of thrown about references to Trump being a threat to democracy without the follow-up. And the follow-up would be easy. I mean, some Republicans are already filing lawsuits in anticipation of challenging the results in November. So that's the threat, and it's real, and it's out there, and it is explainable. But as Ron said, that was kind of Biden's purpose, and Harris has chosen to look forward and create a different message for her campaign.
We're going to take another quick break. Share your thoughts about the debate. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Phone number email address talk@mainpublic.org. We'll hear from Susan from Alfred when we get back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and we are talking about last night's vice presidential debate, part of our Your Vote 2024 coverage. Joining me, Nick Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Government at Colby College, Gene Cummings, former Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, and Ron Schmidt, Political Science Professor and Chair of the Department at USM. Share your comments and questions. If you're quick, you can send an email. talk@mainpublic.org. You can post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We will go to Susan, who's calling from Alfred. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hello. I've been anxious to speak here. First of all, I just got to ask the three speakers, and I respect their position, but they're all pushing a narrative. They're all Democrats. Believe me. I see this so clearly now because I was a Democrat for over 15 years, grew up in an Irish Catholic house. You just became Democrat. I voted for Obama twice.
Susan, I need to
Are
ask you,
you
what did our guests say that made you think that everybody
well,
is
I'll
on
tell you
one
what,
side?
I'll tell you, I will, if you give me a minute, and I will. It was very patronizing. Your female guest, maybe well-intentioned, made it sound like most little American rural people, geez, they don't pay attention. Maybe they don't listen. Maybe they're just too busy. And, maybe some people are. But I'm a little rural American, and I eat, sleep, and drink politics. I watch everything. I read everything. I study everything that's going on globally. So I have a question for all of those three people. First of all, I'd like to see where the proof is of the Project 2025, because that has been debunked and fact-checked. Donald Trump is not a part of Project 25, but that's okay if you want to keep pushing that. J.D. Vance did brilliant last night. And the irony in this is, a year, 2 years ago, Democrats loved him. But now, because he had a change of heart, he became Republican, and I faced the battle.
Susan, there's a lot there. So I'm gonna stop right there, and I'm gonna start with you, Gene. I don't want to speak for you, but we were talking very specifically about undecided voters, correct?
Yes, and also maybe Susan didn't hear me when I said that Donald Trump has rejected the 2025 platform and made clear that that is not his agenda. So I said that wasn't him. That's not his agenda. Susan's right. And so was I. As for busy voters, I wasn't only talking about rural voters. There are suburban voters. There are city voters who have very busy lives and they can't spend every minute. I'm happy for Susan that she is interested and pays a great deal of attention. But there are plenty of suburban voters and rural and city who have kids who are running around to soccer games or basketball games or school events or church events. And they don't spend every waking moment watching every political event. That's who I was referring to. I never said that they were only rural voters. I just said voters.
All right. And I want to just ask you again, Jean, talk to me because, you know, not only did you work at the Wall Street Journal for a long time, but you've covered the Capitol for a very long time. The journalists that we see on talk shows, on panel discussions, whether it's Washington Week on PBS or other programs, how do most of them, in your experience, think about their personal beliefs versus how they cover politics? We all are humans. We all have life experiences, so we can't pretend those don't exist. Yet, on the other hand, everybody's trying their hardest to be objective. How does the Washington Press Corps thread that needle, or most of the people you know?
Well, yes, everything I agree with, kind of the lead up of your question. But one of the things that we have to, there are a couple of things we have to do. We have to be balanced and we have to be fair and we have to try to get objective evidence that we can use to support our stories. So we read polls, we hear focus groups, we use data, we use any information we can. And again, we try to be balanced. So, you know, when you have a debate where there's an instant poll afterwards, it shows there's only 2 or 3 points between the two candidates. You kind of have to say both of them did pretty well. They held their own last night. And I think that's what all of us on the panel have reflected.
All right. And before we say goodbye to Susan, Ron, or Nick, or is there anything you would like to say to her?
Well, I don't want to overlook. I think there is an important point of how Vance and the left, or Vance and the Democratic establishment, have changed relationships. I think the caller is right that in the aftermath of 2016, when coastal elites, and scare quotes, were looking to explain Trump, Vance was brought out every Sunday to explain it to us. But Vance has changed a lot. And the image of rural America, the image of economic opportunity and cultural decay that Vance gave in his book after Hillbilly Elegy and that he touted in the aftermath of 2016 is not the Vance of bigger government, tariffs, you know, we need a hand, the culture is strong of today. And so I agree with the caller that, you know, he was once cozy. But people can change their minds, as Vance is the first to tell you.
Ron?
I think, yeah, my colleagues have said it, have pretty much said it perfectly. I think maybe the important distinction in regard to the question of busy voters is between people who like Susan and like us, spend an enormous amount of time centered on this topic. And, you know, normal people.
Yeah. Susan, thank you for calling with your perspective. A good list of things to discuss there. Let's see, we're going to go up to Portland and Grayson. Hi, Grayson, go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer, thanks for having me on the call. There was a really upsetting thread last night about blaming migrants for the housing crisis and just a lot of scapegoating. And I found that to be just particularly terrifying because, you know, the history of scapegoating just kind of demonstrates that as those things progress, like one group gets blamed, then the next group, then the next group. And I just, you know, that sort of rhetoric coming from that side, I find to be particularly upsetting. Plus, there's very little evidence from what I can tell that migrants contribute anything at all to the housing crisis, which is so multifaceted. So just wanted to hear some comments about that.
Yeah. Jean, I'm going to go back to you.
Well, I agree with the caller. The housing crisis is super complicated, and but it's real. And so I think that it's fair that both sides recognize that it's real. Their solutions are entirely different. But I think that's one of the reasons that we see, you know, the Harris campaign has really zeroed in on this as a way of combating inflation as an issue, because that's a weak point for her. And it's legitimately a weak point for her. And so, you know, Trump and Vance, they emphasize the inflation part of it. She's trying to emphasize her solutions. But certainly, I mean, in Springfield, Ohio, which has gotten so much attention, it seems that most of those migrants are living in apartments, not permanent housing. So, but there are so many things that affect the housing market. It's hard to like point to any particular stream as the thing to look at.
Yeah, and Jean, we're doing, you probably don't know this, Maine Calling Sue, an entire year-long series on all the different aspects of the housing crisis. So we know, Maine Calling listeners know as well as anybody how complicated it is. Go ahead, Ron.
We talked before about how, in regard to the lying, how Governor Walz tried to pick his battles carefully so he didn't wind up defending on everything. And I think it's noteworthy that this is one area where he chose to specify that what J.D. Vance was saying was wrong. Vance has a kind of a disturbing history on issues around immigrants and migration. And as Nick pointed out, on who can be an actual American and who can't. But he presents that in less of a angry, yelling way than Donald Trump does. So I think it's important to point out when he's engaging in this sort of dangerous language.
All right, Grayson, thanks for your call. I thought it was kind of interesting, Nick, and we're talking about housing here. Housing and childcare seem to me sort of newer issues on the campaign stage. In my lifetime, candidates have talked a lot about immigration. They've talked a little bit about energy. But childcare emerging as a number one issue to talk about specific policies in a presidential debate, a sign of the times.
Nothing's off the table anymore when it comes to what the president can and can't do. And childcare, I think that was one of the policy areas that Vance was trying to correct some maybe previous missteps or clarify some earlier remarks. He was in a little hot water a couple weeks ago with comments he made on childcare, and almost seemed to be suggesting like what a proper childcare arrangement is and tying it to this perceived decline of families. But the truth is that there are so many issues. These issues are linked up with one another. I mean, again, we've talked about inflation. We've talked about the higher cost of living, which are hitting different regions and areas within those regions, not equitably, meaning that like even if inflation is coming down on average overall, it is still on the rise in certain parts of America. Even if some parts of America have caught up post-pandemic in terms of job losses, right? Other areas, I'm thinking rural areas here, have actually not. And when people are trying to tell themselves like what are the causes for that deprivation, what are the causes for the fact that I feel like I'm working harder today than I was 5 years ago and not doing any better for it, right? You start pulling all these different pieces together. And so that's why we do live in an era where presidents and vice presidents are expected to speak about childcare and then quickly pivot and talk about the escalating crisis in the Mideast.
Yeah. It's a lot. And I really appreciate all three of you for helping us think through what we saw last night. And also for Ron and Jean, all of your insights over the years. And Nick, thank you. And Joyna, thank you for becoming part of the Maine Calling conversation today. Jean Cummings, former Deputy Bureau Chief in Washington for The Wall Street Journal. Ron Schmidt, Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. And Nick Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Government at Colby College and co-author of a new book about rural voters. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. You can visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter. That's mainecalling.org. Tomorrow on the program, Dale Duff and Bill Green join Keith Shortall to talk about some of Maine's greatest athletes. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.